got the password?
Walt sent me.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 134 of Walt Sent Me, the podcast where we look at the cinematic legacy of the Walt Disney Company and its various subsidiaries. My name is Todd Liebenow, and with me is Kristen Lopez.
Hello.
And this time for Halloween, we are going to take a look at the 1998 Disney Channel original movie, Halloween Town. We've also got a short subject and some news items, so let's start with the news. This first one is something we talked about the possibility of back on our last episode, but now it is official. Soul will not be making its debut in theaters. It's going to be debuting on Disney Plus on Christmas Day. It's a bit of a Christmas present from Disney to all of their fans, but it's not going to be like Mulan. It's not going to be where you have to pay extra. Nope. If you got Disney Plus, you get to see Soul there when you open up your stocking and things like that.
Yeah. Once again, I said this on the last episode. There's nothing major that's coming out this year. 2020 is done with movies. So it was a matter of time before Soul, which was one of the last, I think, remaining major releases of 2020 that had not been moved, to finally decide to either do Disney Plus or wait till next year. It's interesting, a lot of people have been talking about the fact that it's not on their quote-unquote premiere access that they made a big deal of with Mulan, which a lot of people are saying is proof that premium VOD is not working on every movie. I don't know if that's true based off of one feature, but, I definitely think with something like Soul, they probably could have commanded $30 extra on top of that. But I think with something like Disney Plus, most people know that in 3 months, I think once they announced Mulan was going to premium, I think it was maybe about a month in between before they said, oh, and it'll be on the service free of charge in December. So a lot of people just kind of shifted the release date in their head of like, oh, I'll just wait till December and see it for free. Mm-hmm. So I think Disney's still trying to work out necessarily if they can command a premium amount of money and still release these within a relatively short time frame. I think they're still playing a lot of chicken and egg with that. Yeah, but yeah. I'm excited. The reviews for Soul have been really positive. A lot of people saying it's a return to form for Pixar. I know when I saw clips of it at D23, which feels like 75 million years ago, it looked fantastic. So, I'm bummed to not get to see it on a big screen because I know Pixar films are just, they're so beautiful, it really benefits to have a big screen. I would have paid to probably see this in a drive-in as well, but I'll be ready Christmas Day to give this a watch.
Yeah, I'm thinking we may have to carve out some time with my family to watch this on Christmas Day, after you're tired from opening the gifts and all the food has settled and you're, in that relaxed time and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah. But
if anything, our Christmas movie last year was Noel. So,
yeah,
better
yeah.
Christmas movie, maybe?
Well, and I'm thinking this might be a good candidate for our first episode of the new year, to be honest, with the way things are going there. But I do want to talk about the trailer real quick, but jumping back to what you were saying before about what Disney's trying to do and figuring out how they're going to use Disney Plus and streaming platforms and whatnot, I'm wondering if they're kind of looking at some of the success they've had with some of the events, let's say, that they've done with streaming, and I'm thinking mainly of Hamilton. When you look at some of the metrics when it comes to Disney Plus subscriptions coming at the time that Hamilton debuted, I mean, the chart is amazing. There's just this humongous spike in things with people signing up for Disney Plus. I know that's what made my parents, who don't watch a lot of streaming sign up for Disney Plus because they wanted to see Hamilton. And, you know, I wonder if maybe Disney is going for that same type of thing here with Soul, trying to go, hey, it's a new Pixar movie. It's Christmas Day. It's a family time. Here's that Pixar movie that's going to tug at the heartstrings like some of our other films have, and trying to make it into the next event for Disney Plus.
You know, I could see that. I think that you're on to something with the fact that people want to pay for stuff that they can't get anywhere else, that emphasis on exclusivity. And it's something that I know I've been talking with people on social media. What movie would you pay a lot of money to see right this second if they released it? And there are movies. There are people that would be willing to pay to see. I was just saying the other day, I would pay not an exorbitantly large amount, but a significant amount to watch Death on the Nile right now. Yeah. So, you know, I think that there's something to that. You know, if Disney were to release Black Widow onto VOD and still do a theatrical release, you know, whenever they wanted, but you could watch it now, you know, I think that's the stuff that people would be willing to see. It depends on the film. It depends on the need for that film. And it depends on Disney willing to take the risk of they might not make their budget back. I mean, when we talk about VOD in this time right now, the reason stuff is not VOD is because budgets are so high.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to make that return on investment. You cannot put out a movie for $30 if your budget's $200 million. You're never going to make that back. So it'll be interesting to see if anything, you know, once Disney starts greenlighting stuff in the wake of COVID, that's a bit more reasonably budgeted because of how they'll have to deal with safety of actors and all of the post stuff that we're looking at right now. I'd be interested to see if they are open to maybe doing stuff more like that when they know that they can at least maybe break even or start making some money now and then release it 6 months, you know, down the line to a theater where they can make that big money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the trailer, because they launched a second trailer for Soul and gives us a lot more look at things. I mean, the other one was pretty much just a teaser, kind of giving us a few hints about what's going on. And this one gives us a lot bigger look at kind of the world this is presenting us with in terms of the afterlife and also the before life, which I thought, oh, that's an interesting concept there. And also giving us a bit more look at this, at just our world, you know, as it exists with, I think it's Jamie Foxx playing the lead character. And, you know, I'm assuming it's New York or something like that, where he's kind of a jazz musician. And the look of this film is really just, there's a lot of really beautiful shots in that trailer, and a lot of interesting things with some of the characters design too.
Yeah, it looks fantastic. I've talked about I have a soft spot, don't ask me why, for afterlife movies. And I think this one it just looks very fascinating. The fact it's got a person of color leading it in such a significant way. I'm excited. I want to go in as cold as I can for this. So I watched the trailer with the audio off. So I just kind of had the subtitles, because I want to try to go in as cold as I can.
Well, and I haven't looked into this at all as to who's doing music and things like that, but from what I know about the premise and kind of the feel of things, I'm thinking this has hopefully got an amazing soundtrack to it as well. So
I can tell you, because I'm very curious to see if it is Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross.
Oh, my.
So, of course, you have Oscar winners there.
Yeah, that'll be something. All right, well, let's move on. You know, speaking of things that maybe don't necessarily involve actors in the traditional sense. Remember that big hit from a year and a half or so ago, The Lion King, which I still haven't seen yet.
You don't need to still.
Oh, I'll see it. I haven't pulled the trigger yet on it. It's there on Disney Plus, but I haven't watched it yet. But they're doing a sequel, folks, and this is just the most mind-blowing thing about it. They've got Barry Jenkins, the director of Moonlight, to direct this sequel, which, I mean, hey, I'm intrigued. But, yeah, The Lion King 2. What Shakespeare story are they going to do this time?
Okay, so I got to break this down a little bit. I've met Barry Jenkins. He's awesome, and I think he's great. And I have no problem with directors of color making that sweet franchise money. Disney should pay him handsomely for whatever he gives them. And I'm sure that whatever he gives them will be interesting. The question is what is he giving them? Because, yeah, you're right. I mean, is this a sequel in the sense of The Lion King had sequels?
Yeah, direct-to-video sequels. Mm-hmm.
They had direct-to-video sequels, which I doubt. I know social media was kind of hoping that they would borrow some stuff.
Don't count on it. Yeah.
I don't see Disney acknowledging that those things exist. And the problem is that, as most people know, I mean, The Lion King did not make a huge amount of money. I mean, it made a lot of money, but to justify how much they spent, it didn't do that great. It was also rather critically, I don't want to say reviled, but people didn't like it. I mean, the problem was it was the apotheosis of why does this exist? So I don't know. This feels like a parody film almost. I have no idea what to say about it because I don't understand why it's a thing at all.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's a thing to make money, I mean, basically, but yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see, and I suppose this could factor into our previous discussion, too, just, you know, in terms of how is Disney going to handle things going forward? You know, is this something that, you know, perhaps, you know, is going to be a better vehicle to land on Disney Plus and have another event type thing? Who knows? But, yeah, Barry Jenkins, an interesting choice. I mean, I'm intrigued, for sure. It looks like it's going to be the same writer as the original one, Jeff Nathanson, but yeah, we'll see what happens. All right, so our last bit of news here, continuing the trend of you know, taking whatever intellectual property is out there for Disney to try and make a movie out of. You know, we've had various rides turned into movies. You know, Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, that was a ride first. And, you know, the Jungle Cruise is on the way. We were supposed to have it by now, but it'll be coming. We've had the Haunted Mansion, talk of another Haunted Mansion. Well, now, Space Mountain, a movie based on Space Mountain, is in development, which I'm going, based on Space Mountain basically just means it's got the name Space Mountain, because there's no narrative to Space Mountain. You hop in a little, you know, rocket coaster and you go up and down hills in the dark. There's nothing to it. So I'm like, what are they going to do with a movie version of Space Mountain? I don't know.
Yeah, I have absolutely no idea, again, why this exists. Because keep in mind, I mean, most of the movies that we've adapted from Disney rides have stories ingrained. I mean, there's a rich history with Haunted Mansion. There's a rich backstory there. Pirates of the Caribbean. Pirates invade a town. I mean, there you have a narrative there. Even something like, you know, Jungle Cruise, the concept of, you know, 1940s skippers. I mean, even though that's not going to be utilized in the film, that's still ingrained in the narrative. You know, you have things. Space Mountain, yeah, it's a roller coaster. I mean, usually roller coasters are named after movies, not the other way around. So
yeah.
I have zero idea other than it's going to be some sort of sci-fi colonization type of thing, which, you know, I thought John Carter turned us off of space movies with Disney.
Well,
so
I'm wondering, is this going to be like Tomorrowland all over again? You know, I mean, because there was something where, again, it was like, well,
Justice,
you know,
for Tomorrowland. Tomorrowland,
well,
is a great hour.
I think there are things about Tomorrowland I enjoyed very much. But, you know, based on how excited we all were after that trailer and, you know, Brad Bird's pedigree and such, Tomorrowland did let me down a bit. And, you know, that's another case where it's basically, well, we have a cool name and it ties into the theme park, so let's do something. And I'm going, well, that's kind of what we're looking at with Space Mountain here, too.
And there's no director or script associate. There's nobody announced there yet, right?
I think I did see on the writing side of things, let's see, Joby Harold, who did King Arthur Legend of the Sword.
Oh, that's promising.
Yeah, I don't know.
Am I the only one who saw King Arthur Legend? I take it back.
I saw
25 minutes of King Arthur Legend of the Sword. Then I went on living my life.
I didn't see it. I'm typically open to just about anything. But, yeah, I did have some people basically tell me you don't want to see King Arthur Legend of the Sword.
I mean, I'm putting money down. If it's associated with King Arthur Legend of the Sword, Guy Ritchie is going to direct this. Pardon me now.
Yeah, jump right off of Aladdin 2 or whatever and come over to Space Mountain. Sure, whatever. All right, well, that's all the news that we have this time, so let's talk about a short.
Okay, so our short this week is from 1930. It is called Simply Autumn. It's the story of a bunch of woodland critters making music with autumn stuff. I'm sorry, Todd. I watched all 6.5 minutes of this short. I did not discern a plot.
At all. There's no plot. It's a silly symphony. So, yeah.
Exactly. There's no plot. I think we should emphasize it's an early silly symphony.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's the problem, is that it's pretty much 6.5 minutes of watching things dance. And that's fine. The problem is if you've seen as many of them as we have, it's kind of old. You know, watching woodland critters dance is like, oh, skeletons dance, snowman dance. I've seen everything dance, you know.
Yeah.
This did nothing for me, really, aside from the fact that the woodland critters kind of look like Mickey Mouse prototypes.
That's what I was thinking. I was thinking pretty much every one of these, you know, woodland creatures is essentially just a modified version of Mickey Mouse, because it starts with what I assumed were squirrels, which, you know, looked like furry versions of Mickey Mouse. And I mean, even down to, you know, having like rounded ears. I'm like, squirrels don't have round ears, but these ones did. And then there was a skunk in there somewhere that looked just like the squirrels, except he had a white stripe down his tail. And then you had beavers that looked just like the skunk and the squirrels, except they had flat tails. And, you know, it was just, yeah, different versions of Mickey Mouse. And, you know, I understand, because it's early animation. They, you know, it was a challenge enough to get this stuff on the screen. But, yeah, you're kind of hungry for when they would get to where they are putting a little bit more variety into the creatures and the settings and what they're doing. I mean, you know, with these early shorts where it's just a lot of music and dancing critters and things like that, you know, every gag, every, you know, gesture is going to be repeated, because back then they were in the mindset of, well, it was funny the first time, we're going to do it a second time. You know, it pads out the short and cuts down on the animation, and, you know, it'll be fun. But yeah, watching it now, it just kind of gets a little bit monotonous. I can appreciate certain things about this as far as just the development of the art form of animation, but yeah, there's not a lot to it for sure.
Yeah, this was only the sixth Silly Symphony ever, as well as the third of their seasons series. They had done Springtime in 1929. They had done Summer just a couple months prior to the release of Autumn.
Appropriately.
And then they wouldn't do Winter until close to the end of the year. So they kind of knocked through the seasons pretty quickly. It was interesting. I found a review from Motion Picture News in 1930 of the short that calls it, quote, well done, but constructed along the same lines as most cartoons, the majority of which depend on fantastic stepping by the animal characters to put it over. And that really sums this up. I mean, it's really just a kind of a case of watching characters go from the left of the frame to the right of the frame. It's very automated.
Yeah.
So that's like watching the crows deliver the corn cobs from frame left to frame right and drop them in the scarecrow. So it's very much, you can see, I mean, because most of it's handmade, you know, the concept of kind of like having that left to right progression that does tend to get a little repetitious towards the end.
Yeah, and I thought there were, you know, certainly missed opportunities with it, because, you know, they introduce some elements that they just don't really develop. When I saw the scarecrow hanging there, I thought, oh, we'll see the scarecrow come to life or something like that. And again, I'm thinking back to much better shorts like the skeleton dance, but no, that doesn't happen. You know, the other thing that really bugged me about this, too, is that I was going, you know, even if it was just critters dancing around in an autumn setting and all that, this might have been a more effective short had they done it maybe a few years later. And the reason I'm thinking that is that when I think of the different seasons, and I think of autumn specifically, I think about color. I think about the colors of the leaves changing and you know, just the unique tones and such that you get in an autumn environment. And with this being a black and white short, you don't get that. It looks more like winter, to be honest, and there happens to be a few leaves lying around. A few years later, when we had color cartoons, this is still 2 years before flowers and trees, so color wasn't a part of the picture yet. But, you know, had they done this exact same thing when they could do color, I probably would have enjoyed it a lot more.
Exactly, yeah. It's definitely something that is both hindered by the time frame. I mean, keep in mind, just 2 years later, they would do flowers and trees and then transition into color. So it is a bit of a missed opportunity not to emphasize the color element. But it also is a missed opportunity not to discuss the elements that we associate with fall. You brought the scarecrow up. You know, that really goes nowhere. I don't associate autumn with, like, beavers and...
Yeah.
Little bears and stuff like that, you know, I or crows for that matter. It's just, it really doesn't seem to capture what the spirit of the season itself is, especially because they had just done summer just a couple months before this. And, you know, summer is one where I don't even know if we've done this short yet, but it's something where I'm just kind of like, it almost feels like they just might have recycled a lot of the animation, I'm guessing, from that previous short. I have no proof of that. But
yeah, they may have. I don't think we've done any of the other season ones. I know that they did all four seasons, but I think this is the first time we've hit on it. I usually, on a Halloween episode, I try to look for something spooky, but yeah, I think we've pretty much run through all the spooky ones. So we ended up here, but... Yeah, not the greatest of the silly symphonies. We should mention, though, I mean, there's certainly some big-name people involved with this. I mean, it's basically under the direction of Ub Iwerks, who, you know, big pioneer in Disney animation. Some would say he's more so the creator of Mickey Mouse than Walt Disney himself. And we've got a bunch of other animators who we've mentioned before as directors of these shorts, you know, as the years progressed, you know, people like Wilfred Jackson and Ben Sharpstein and Jack King and Burt Gillette. Those are all names we've talked about before. They all worked on this. And you also have Carl Stalling, legendary composer of music for animation, doing the music for this. But yeah, you know, I'm sure they all did a fine job, working on this, but it's definitely not the high point for any of them. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break here. We'll hear from another Light Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our look at Halloween Town.
He brings the popcorn. She brings the roses. Subject Cinema, a tasty new film topic each week with a side order of film reviews.
Yum.
T.C. Kirkham.
Ba-dum-ching.
Kim Brown.
What?
Over 500,000 listeners, and you could be the next one. SubjectCinema.com.
Real movies for real people.
Bubble, toil, and trouble. But it's coming.
Oh, hi,
yes.
Grandma.
Oh, my stars. How did you get here?
On the bus. I came to start my training, Grandma.
Your train? Oh, it was you outside the kitchen. I thought I heard someone listening. Well, I suppose I can assume your mother doesn't know you're here. I dare say that she's going to be very upset when she finds you're gone.
Can't we just call her?
No, no, dear. I'm afraid we haven't worked out long-distance calling between worlds yet. No, I'll have to take you home myself.
Oh, but you can't take us home.
Yeah, we want to help you fight the bad thing.
Yeah, the bad thing, or the force field, whatever it is. You said you needed another Cromwell witch. That could be me. You can train me.
Yeah, well, I suppose it'd be all right. You could stay a little while. As long as we get you home before it's midnight in the mortal world.
But that's only 2 hours from now.
Well, don't panic, dear. You see, time works differently in Halloween Town. 2 hours there might be 2 days here, or 2 weeks if we're on vacation.
What's this, Grandma?
Ah, you've discovered the witch's glass. It's been handed down from the Cromwell clan over many generations. I've been using it to keep my eye on things. Now Now the glass shows me that some evil force is at work here in Halloween Town. Also, the worst is yet to come.
What can we do to stop it?
I'll show you.
All right, so our feature film this time is a Disney Channel original movie from 1998, Halloween Town. This premiered on the Disney Channel on October 17th, 1998, and I'm sure aired many, many more times because I've definitely heard from people that were children of the 90s that they have a special place in their heart for this film. But this was my first time ever seeing it because I was 27 years old in 1998, so I wasn't the target audience for this. I didn't have kids yet or anything like that. But it's directed by Dwayne Dunham, who has done a lot of things in the movie industry, primarily working as an editor. This guy edited some big movies, things like Return of the Jedi and Blue Velvet for David Lynch. And he was an editor on Twin Peaks for Lynch as well. But he eventually moved on to directing, did a lot of television. He did Homeward Bound, The Incredible Journey, and has done various other TV shows. He directed a few episodes of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. So, you know, he's had his hand in a lot of things. But this has a cast spanning decades age-wise, with the big star here being Debbie Reynolds. But we've also got folks like Judith Hogue, who I always remember from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. She was April O'Neil in the first Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. But Kimberly J. Brown, Joey Zimmerman, a number of other people. But yeah, as I said, this was not something I had seen before. This was not something I was seeking out. But Kristen, you're much more of a young pup than I am. What's your background with Halloween Town?
Halloween Town was a big deal for me when it came out. I want to say it was one of the first big Disney Channel original movies, the DCOMs as we've come to call them, ushering in the late 1990s into the new millennium. The Disney Channel rebranded itself as quote-unquote Zoom Disney, because millennium, if anybody remembers. And it decided that they were going to inject some money into the network, and they started getting a lot of original programming, started to aim it more at a tween audience, what we know now as a tween audience. And they started doing movies, high quality for a TV film, movies aimed at a family audience. And I don't know if Halloween Town was the first. I know it was one of the earliest that would usher in a lot of other Disney Channel original movies that a lot of people my age love, so maybe we'll do more of them, but this was a big deal for me. It wasn't just that it was a Halloween movie, but it was the fact that Kimberly J. Brown was a big deal on the Disney Channel. She had done a couple other things associated with the network, and so she was kind of there. I don't want to say Annette Funicello, because that's not how she was, but she was like essentially like the Hilary Duff.
I was going to say, there were a number, as we go through the years, there's a number of young performers, and actually, I would say primarily a bunch of young actresses who have been that kind of it girl for the Disney Channel at the time, whether it's Miley Cyrus or Selena Gomez or, like you said, Hilary Duff, these folks who kind of got their start with Disney Channel shows and movies.
Yeah, Kimberly J. Brown, I mean, she had done a couple films. I knew her best. She did a movie about a year later called Tumbleweeds, which is one of my favorites. But she did a lot of this. She also was on the Olsen Twins when they had a television show called Two of a Kind. She had a recurring role on there. And, of course, she did other Disney Channel original movies, including Quince, Halloween Town 2, Halloween Town High. So it was a big deal. It was a big deal when it came out. And I remember this became a big Halloween staple, along with a couple other Disney Channel original movies like Under Wraps, which is not on Disney Plus, which is really frustrating because it's one of my favorites, and stuff like Don't Look Under the Bed. So it was a bright, shining time in the late 90s on the Disney Channel. It was magic. And what's funny is Judith Hogue might be Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles to you. She was the snippy ex-wife that was mean in Armageddon which is how I remember her.
Oh my gosh, you blew my mind. I totally did not realize that was her.
Ironically, I was watching Armageddon literally before I started rewatching Halloween Town, so it was fresh in my mind.
Well, yeah. Well, give us the lowdown on what Halloween Town is all about, and then we can dig into it here.
Halloween Town is the story of a 13-year-old girl named Marnie Piper, played by Kimberly J. Brown, who wants to be where the people are.
She does. I guess you're right.
Her mom is very anti-Halloween for reasons that she just does not get. They are not allowed to go out. They're not allowed to leave the house on Halloween night. They can't consume candy. They can't wear costumes. Halloween is an anathema to them, and it has nothing to do with religion.
So it's like 2020, you're saying.
Exactly. And of course, their grandmother, Aggie, played by Debbie Reynolds, shows up for her annual Halloween visit and starts dropping hints about weird stuff. Marnie has deja vu a lot. Her sister has weird little tics. But come to find out that their grandmother lives in a place called Halloween Town that is in some sort of other dimension. And Marnie and her brother Dylan and her sister Sophie stow away on the bus and follow their grandmother to Halloween Town. And once they get there, they feel, you know, Marnie especially feels that she belongs. She discovers that she is a witch. But there's something evil happening in Halloween Town. People are turning mean and then they're disappearing. And when Grandma Aggie gets caught up in it, it's up to the kids to solve the mystery, get Mom on the side of Halloween, and let Marnie be the lovable witch that she's born to be.
So, my first time watching this here, and, you know, of course, as
a grown man.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I've got to kind of put myself into a younger frame of mind, I guess, watching this. You know, I certainly saw the charms that this movie has and, you know, can see why, you know, folks that were of that age in the 90s certainly, found something to connect with this movie. I wondered, too, about kind of how this fits in with another phenomenon, a much bigger phenomenon that was going on at this time, because, you know, I realized as I was looking back at the calendar and the big events of this period of the 90s, this movie is coming out just about a year and a half after the release of a little book called Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, or Philosopher's Stone, depending on where you live. And there were certainly a lot of things about this that I thought, this feels a little Harry Potter-ish with the way that it's approaching the idea of witches and being born into a family of witches and having to train to be a witch and that type of thing. So I was wondering if this was like Disney kind of realizing early that there was something to this, you know, growing Potterverse thing that was starting to infect kids all over the world.
You know, it's something that I didn't think of until you just brought it up, and that's very much a possibility that could have happened. I mean, you know, witches and wizardry was a big thing. And, you know, I think that could be a serious possibility. Keep in mind, too, Harry Potter was definitely, I think, a book and eventually a film series that drew in audiences of all genders. But it's still a boy protagonist. And Halloween Town, I think, really did cater to that young girl element of the supernatural. It's also important to remember the 90s especially, and you know, it's funny, if you watch Pen 15, they've made fun of it, especially, you know, teenage girls always go through a witchcraft phase. We all do. And this fit right into that. I think that's what this movie really catered to, was that tween element of, we're not going to talk about the logistics of magic, you know, but we're going to say that it exists. We're going to say that you can engage in it in a safe and family-friendly way. So I think it really did appeal to that group of young girls who loved Hermione from Harry Potter but wanted her to have her own story in some way.
Yeah, I can certainly see that. I mean, you know, when there's various things in this that just really echo Harry Potter. I mean, you know, the whole broomstick thing especially was the thing that grabbed me, where, you know, they go to this – place, and it's almost like a used car lot type of thing with the broomsticks and the way they have the different models and different features to them. And I thought, oh, this reminds me very much of just the importance that the kids put on the broomstick in Harry Potter and all that. But, you know, I want to say it's a ripoff of Harry Potter, because it's not. It does something very different with stuff. I think that in a lot of ways, this is a case where the kind of the concept is better than the story. You know, it's got a interesting idea in terms of, you know, there's this town where, you know, all these Halloween creatures live and things like that. But then they kind of said, oh, yeah, we actually have to have something happen. And so, the thing with the whole villainous guy in the you know, the black cloak and all that, and the freezing of the townspeople and whatnot, it kind of felt like it was just like, well, you know, we got to tack on some kind of conflict here, because I didn't think that was very effective. I never really quite got what the whole motivation of the villain was, other than just the fact that he was a villain. But I enjoyed kind of just the environment and, you know, this kind of strange little almost Mayberry-like, Leave It to Beaver type of little suburban American town that just happens to be inhabited by strange Halloween creatures.
Yeah, I definitely love the world building of this. Again, it shows kind of the attention to detail that the DCOMs were slowly starting to have. This was only the fourth in the revitalization of the Disney Channel original movies. They'd only been doing it for less than a year, but the world building was something that would continue, I think, into the next year when they did Xenon, Girl of the 21st Century, which is a space set futuristic world, stuff like Smart House. The world building's great, you know, and I really did love those scenes of Marnie and Dylan and Sophie getting off the bus and pretty much entering a world where fall threw up. You know, it feels very welcoming. It's like Disneyland, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And again, it's this Disneyland version of Halloween that's very safe and welcoming. And it has a very slight message of, like, we're different, but we're the same type of thing. You know, it doesn't go as, like, hardcore as, like, The Color of Friendship in terms of, like, talking about the inhabitants of Halloween Town being, you know, a different race or ethnicity or anything like that. But it does situate this world as, you know, people felt like they were outcasts and finding a way to coexist. But you're right that Calabar's plan is really ill-defined. You know, this movie is, what is it, less than 90 minutes? Mm-hmm. It's 84.
Yeah.
And Calabar is supposed to be this big bad. You know, he shows up as this guy that it might have had a thing for Marnie's mom. And really, once Marnie's mom shows up, the movie pitches forward into third act.
Yeah.
You know, and I kind of would have liked a bit more of, like, Calabar maybe trying to woo her. You know, even something on the TV, you know, they spend a lot of time going back and forth to Marnie's mother watching the television and kind of berating it for saying stuff works like magic, and she's like, no, it doesn't. I would have liked some discussion about maybe if Calabar's plan is to merge Halloween Town with with Earth. I don't know how the parallel universes thing works, but you know, if that's his goal, I would have liked to have seen maybe some indication that stuff was slipping through into our world in some way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I kind of struggled with just the idea that they, you know, his whole thing is he gives this big speech to the citizens of Halloween Town and talks about them being second class citizens and things like that, which when you brought it up there, I thought, well, yeah, that is kind of an intriguing angle there. But I'm kind of sitting there going, but things look cooler in Halloween Town. You guys have powers. You can fly. You've got a bus that zooms around in the air.
And
you know,
let's talk about the obvious. I don't see oppression. I don't see poverty. You know?
I said, it looks like, you know, Leave It to Beaver's hometown. Everything's perfect there. You know, the Brady Bunch lives down the road.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, the Disney Channel original formula is something that has to be complex, but not too complex for tweens to not get it. And I think this movie is safe. It's safe in a lot of ways. It could have probably afforded to be a bit more complex. You know, I think of the first DCOM, which was Under Wraps, released the year before, and how that is really a story about, you know, kids finding a mummy, but it's also about a kid dealing with the fact that his dad's passed, and his mom wants to date. You know, and I think that that's really good in terms of using a supernatural element to talk about a real-world problem. Halloween Town does not do that. You know, Halloween Town does, the real-world problem is that Marnie feels, and I don't even know if it's something that Marnie feels per se, you know, I think she feels different. You know, that teenage girl malaise of like, I feel weird. You know, who am I? What am I? But it's something that the movie really doesn't seem to know how to explore with any type of nuance. You know, keep in mind, this movie is not just directed by a man. It's written by two guys and one girl, who I don't know how much input she had in the story. And so it does feel like, you know, this is a movie about a teenage girl, a teenage witch, which, by the way, Sabrina the Teenage Witch, I think, also premiered around the same time as this. But it doesn't really seem to get why she feels different, you know, why she feels like an outcast. It really does at the end of it all, and I noticed it a lot when I was rewatching it the other day, it really does feel like a family that wants to celebrate Halloween, and they can't, and trying to convince their mom that they can. It's why, controversial opinion, I think Halloween Town 2 is the better movie.
Well, I mean, one of the things about this is that there are certainly opportunities for this story to go into some of those darker places, but it never does. I mean, you're kind of talking about how, you know, it's never really explored why Marnie is struggling, why does she feel different, things like that. And I think you could have gone into a little bit more just the struggles of a teenage girl. You know, there it's mentioned that the father, who's not in the picture, has, I think, died. But again, it's just a mention. And we don't explore that anything more. You know, there's this element of the mother maybe having once been high school sweethearts or something like that with the villain. But that darker element really isn't explored. And even just the fact that there should be darker elements to a town that's full of skeletons and werewolves and stuff, they're all very happy skeletons and werewolves and things like that. So just that kind of general Halloween creepiness or darkness is not explored as much. And maybe that's just because it's Disney, and it's a Disney Channel movie, and, you know, they were maybe not as willing to go to those darker places back then. You know, this is well before we have Keira Knightley on the deck of a ship with a bunch of skeletons, you know?
But it's also important to point out that this was also a world where we had Nightmare Before Christmas.
When did that one hit?
That was, like, 94.
That was a few years earlier, but that's also... Yeah. I mean, that's also a theatrical feature, and it's also where they kind of, you know, were letting Tim Burton do whatever he wanted, you know, so.
And I mean, that could be it. You know, also you're dealing with a TV movie, you have a bit of a cheaper budget, you have less time to work on stuff like that. So it's understandable. I think rewatching it this time around, I really did see more of the flaws. But you're totally right. I mean, really, the villains are too white dudes, you know, like, it's Calabar is the big bad, and then he has his little underling Luke, and you know, you start to think that maybe Luke might be, I don't know, important, you know, just kind of the kid that, like, shows up and talks trash and then, like, goes into the shadows. I mean, it isn't until the final, like, 30 seconds of the movie that you realize that he's got, like, some sort of gnome face. That Calabar kind of promised him a nice-looking face if he worked for him. And I started to realize, I'm like, wait, no, didn't he have that gnomey weird face, like, in the whole movie? And then I realized I was thinking about two.
That I was wondering about, because when the character is introduced, I think they're in the cab, and I think the skeleton driver, which I love the skeleton. I would talk about that puppet later. But, you know, he says something about, oh, that kid's no good. And they kind of drive by, and Marty's kind of looking out the window, and I'm going, what? Why? What's wrong with him? And I'm going, oh, no, here's the love interest. You know, this, and you know, I thought this is going to be the bad news but dreamy, you know, love interest kid. And, you know, they don't really go too far with that. I know you said there's a bunch of sequels. I don't know. Is there a love story in the sequels here?
Yes. The Luke and Marty thing does, so Halloween Town 2, Calabar's Revenge, I think came out, I want to say, about two or three years after this. So Kimberly J. Brown was a teenager by this point. So I think they felt a bit more comfortable maybe making her a love interest. But yeah, the whole, it's a similar plot line, actually. She falls for a guy that she thinks is really, really cute. But also there's this love triangle with Luke, who's like friend zoned. And then you find out, spoiler alert, that Cal is the guy that she's into is really Calabar's son, who's seeking vengeance. And so, yeah, it kind of plays out along the same lines. But I will give it credit. This movie has some of my favorite weird one-liners, such as little Sophie saying, "Hey, there's the wiener dude."
Yeah. There are a few good moments in there where it's just, there's a little line or a little visual that I thought, well, that's clever. The one that got me was the microwave with the buttons for bubble, toil and trouble, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. I love the Debbie Reynolds character being like, "Oh, this is what happens when I use instant," you know, stuff like that. I think it tends to fall apart when they go on the quote unquote road trip to find all the little items. So you see the limits of the budget when they're trying to, you know, deal with ghosts and get like ghost sweat. The ghost sounds like Jimmy Cagney. I don't understand that. or like the werewolf. There's a lot of like, there's a weird interest in making all these characters feel like they're from the 50s or the 1930s. So characters like talk like Elvis,
right?
Or they act like they're a doo-wop singer or something. I don't get where that goes, but I do think that some of the stuff that they try to bring over from the human world is pretty inventive.
Well, it's kind of like some of the things you were pointing out about Monsters Incorporated last time, where you commented how the monsters don't use deodorant, they use odorant, you know, and there are some things like that in this movie. I think it does a pretty good job with that. And, the creatures are fun. It's not the highest level of makeup, but there's some fun stuff going on there. And like I said, that skeleton puppet, that was my favorite thing. This cab driver that is the skeleton, and it's got some really good animation of the different features. I wouldn't have thought you could make that much movement in just, a skull for a face, but it's very effective.
Yeah, Benny is pretty interesting. If anything, I love the weird moment where he kind of turns evil and you think he might be some sort of hell spawn or something. I thought that was cool, even though it doesn't last very long.
Now, we should jump into the cast a little bit more here, because we've talked about various people, but we have actually, for two classic film fans, I'm ashamed of both of us here for not really mentioning Debbie Reynolds very much.
Debbie!
It's interesting. I was looking on Letterboxd, okay? And, when you click on an actor or an actress on Letterboxd, and it shows you their films, and it puts them in order by popularity, the way, as people have rated them and watched them and logged it on Letterboxd. And for Debbie Reynolds, this classic film star with this huge filmography and such, Singing in the Rain, of course, has the top spot. But pretty much right behind it is Halloween Town. Because, again,
you have to remember, exactly, yeah, a lot of people my age discovered Debbie through those movies.
Well, yeah, and I'm thinking that this is, probably the place where a lot of folks of your generation would have gotten to know her, and I think she is wonderful in this. I mean, it's, first of all, I find it really interesting just that, Disney landed somebody like Debbie Reynolds for a movie like this, but, I think she's clearly having a great time doing this, and, what they do with her character I think is fun. It's kind of like, the way I thought of it is she's like more of the traditional witch version of Mary Poppins, I mean, her introduction very much makes you think of Mary Poppins, the way she kind of lowers down from the bus that's floating over the street there. I was like, oh my gosh, it's Mary Poppins.
Yeah. Debbie is, I'm a huge Debbie Reynolds fan. And this was, I think, maybe one of the first Debbie Reynolds films, it's been a while, that I've seen since she died. And it was bittersweet to watch this, because I love her so much, but she's so good in it. You mentioned she looks, she's having a great time, and I think that's true. Debbie Reynolds worked consistently throughout her whole life. I mean, I think that's amazing. Mm-hmm. In 98 alone, she did 6 movies, 2 TV films, a voice performance, and 2 voice performances, and she had continued working, started transitioning into more TV and voice work, but she does such great great work in this movie. I think the fact that she's playing a grandmother, which, you know, depending on if you've read interviews and stuff, you know, she wasn't completely comfortable with, according to her daughter. But I think she's so sweet and warm and welcoming, you know, and she's such a spitfire too, which I love, is that, you know, she's this little itty bitty thing and she's, you know, willing to stand up to the mayor, you know, even before she knows he's the villain. You know, she like gets up in his face and is like, dude, you need to crack this case, because like I'm a one-woman detective agency, man. I need some help. And I love that. I love that about her. And I do like that the movies, as they went on, especially in two, I think, again, is really good to her character, in the sense that this movie ends with Grandma Aggie going to Earth. I keep saying Earth. I'm assuming it's a different planet. She's going to Earth to live with Marnie and her family, and in the second film, it's a lot about how she feels adrift. She doesn't feel useful, just kind of being the mortal grandma that lives in the other room. And I think that that's really fascinating for her character arc. It takes her down some interesting roads, but she is so much fun in this movie. She did all four, so.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of part of why I say that she's clearly enjoying herself with this. I mean, because I could tell by looking up her filmography, she kept coming back to the series, and you know, I think it's clear that she was really enjoying this. I mean, it's great to see her in that kind of cool grandma type mode. And I mean, you know, it's like, yeah, I mean, Debbie Reynolds would be a cool grandma, you know? I mean, come on. So yeah, I thought she was definitely the highlight here. You know, how do you think the others do here? I mean, we've kind of talked a little bit about Kimberly J. Brown, but yeah, what's your take on her performance in general?
I think Kimberly J. Brown is a great every woman, you know, in the sense that she's not a glamazon, you know, she's not Kristen Storms in the Xenon movies, you know, she's an average girl, and I think that really helps you bond to Marnie, is that she says there's nothing special about her, but in that sense, she is every young girl who feels that same thing about themselves. And she's got, you know, that snappy teenager quality, you know, kind of berating her mother and being like, you know, she's not going to school, she's not speaking to her. I mean, she really, the script, I think, gets down that relationship dynamic between mother and daughter. I wish there had been a bit more nuance and more affection between the two of them, because it seems that they're very much at odds at the beginning, and then they like hug, and you're just kind of like, I still don't believe they like each other.
There's a little bit too much of just, you know, the default for Judith Hogue's character is just no, because I said so, and
Well, but I think Kimberly J. Brown does really well opposite Joey Zimmerman and Emily Roeske, who play Dylan and Sophie, her siblings. You know, she has that quality of when the adults get taken, you know, that she's going to take charge and she's going to figure it out. While also wanting to, you know, be a witch, which, you know, kind of competes for that time. But I think she's really good. And I thought the other two child stars, I thought Emily Roeske, who plays Sophie, is just adorable, you know, that she remembers the spells, like their songs. She has that premonition of, like, knowing when people are coming, and her spell casting is just kind of having a tantrum and something happens. I think that's really good. And, of course, you have to have a straight man. You know, you got to have the skeptic. So you have the brother, Dylan, the boy who doesn't believe in anything, and he's solid. You know, he's the what's the boy in Peter Pan whose name I can't remember?
Oh,
like the glasses. It's
John.
John. Yeah, John. Yeah. I was gonna say John and Michael. He's the John. Sophie's the Michael. And
see that.
Marnie is the Wendy, essentially. But they're all good.
I agree for the most part. I did enjoy the little girl. She reminded me very much of she was Mara Wilson. You know, to compare to another star from this time frame, she reminded me a lot of her. The boy, I don't know. There were a few moments where, you know, he kind of made me chuckle. I liked the dynamic between him and his sisters. But at the same time, there were also moments where I was going, this kid's getting on my nerves a little bit. This is another Charles Wallace. I'm going to tear my hair out here, you know?
Justice for Charles Wallace. Okay. No, I thought Dylan's way more unlikable than Charles Wallace. Charles Wallace, I think, is likable. But no, I mean, these characters aren't really characters. They fall into, you know, and I think that's the problem, is that they are very trope-like. They don't really necessarily have personality. And again, you know, it's unfortunate. I think that Halloween Town was one of the earliest features in the DCOM world, because I do think the acting got better. You know, they also were hiring better actors at that point. Not to say that Kimberly J. Brown wasn't good, but, you know, after a certain part, they were really bringing on child actors that we've seen in other stuff, so that, you know, they had name recognition. I mean, Kirsten Storms, who was Xenon, had done soaps. So, you know, they had acting talent. Not to say Kimberly J. Brown didn't have credits. She did. But I think that there was more of a desire of not just letting the child star hold the film, but making sure that everybody was on their level. And Halloween Town is a great start, but when one of the actors is just kind of okay, you really feel it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all around with the DCONs, you know, I mean, as they progressed, I mean, this was only the fourth one, you know, the acting got better, the production value got better, because Disney saw the formula was working. So, yeah, you have mentioned the sequels a little bit. Before we get on to pins and ratings and such, I don't know if you've seen them all, but, you know, give us kind of a lowdown on you know, what transpired after the first visit to Halloween Town.
So I already mentioned Halloween Town 2, Calabar's Revenge, which came out in 2002, directed by Mary Lambert, who did Pet Sematary, which is probably why I love it so much.
Shared universe.
Oh my God, that's great. And it's written by two of the same screenwriters of the original film. Pretty much everybody came back. And I mentioned that the plot is about Calabar's son. Don't ask where that happens in the timeline. Comes back to seek revenge on Halloween Town and the Cromwells for killing his dad. And then they took a couple years off, 3 years, came back in 2004 for Halloween Town High, which was directed by Mark A.Z. DePay and written by none of the original writers, but it did bring Kimberly J. Brown, Joey Zimmerman, Judith Togue, Debbie Reynolds. They all came back and with Marnie preparing to kind of vacillate between the Halloween Town world and the mortal world, and she wants to bring a group of Halloween Town students to her high school in the mortal world, and hilarity ensues. I remember the big deal about this was that Lucas Grabeel was in it, who was, I guess, hot off of High School Musical, and so that was a thing. And then you would return to Halloween Town 2006. It was the last one. They had a couple people from the original film come back, but it was essentially all new characters. You'd see Sarah Paxton in the lead, written by a mess of other writers, directed by somebody else. But you have Marnie at this point, who has been... Okay, so Marnie's recast in this last one. And they did get Judith Hogue back. They got Joey Zimmerman back. They got Debbie Reynolds back. They did not get Kimberly J. Brown back, but it's essentially an 18-year-old Marnie deciding to go to which university in Halloween Town, learning more about her life. This last one, unlike the last three, which all got really positive reviews, this one was a bit mixed. People were really upset that Kimberly J. Brown was not cast, despite her saying that she was available. It's unclear whether there was some bad blood, or maybe because Kimberly J. Brown looked like an average 18-year-old and she wasn't a hot, skinny mini. That's my theory, at least. It was unfortunate. A lot of people don't like it. I've only seen the first two, so I can't tell you if the three and four are worth it.
Well, they are all on Disney Plus, so
yes.
You can check them out there. All right, well, let's do some pins here and then our ratings. So if you were to find some pins for Halloween Town down at Disneyland, who knows, they might even exist. But what would you be looking for?
Of course, the Halloween Town pumpkin that is the statue for the town, I guess.
Right. Yeah, it plays a part in the big finale, yeah.
Marty's broom, the broom that she buys at the broom car lot.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the ghost in the sweat box, which I think is pretty funny. And, of course, Debbie Reynolds, because Debbie Reynolds deserves a pin.
Yes, I was going to say, you got to have a Debbie Reynolds pin in there, so that would be something. Yeah, your sweatbox ghost could have moving parts, you know, can open and close, you know, just like in the movie there. She's a sweatbox ghost like the hatbox ghost, because that's that legendary
thing.
That
was its brother. That was its brother that it doesn't talk to.
Yeah. So I also had down, I don't know, for some reason I just found the hairdresser that was a werewolf to be weirdly funny. So I'd like to have one of him. And, of course, Benny, the skeleton cab driver, I thought was great. So that's one I would want on a pin. All right, so what are you going to rate Halloween Town on the scale of 5 Mickey heads?
I give it a 3. It's solid. It's a good beginning. It's entertaining. You know, if you have kids, I think they'll have a lot of fun with it. It's a great nostalgia watch for me.
Yeah, I agree 100%. 3 is exactly what I was thinking for it as well. It's definitely it's not deep. It's kids fair, family fair type of thing, but it's solid. It's entertaining, has some interesting things going on, and I may actually be somewhat motivated to check out the follow-ups. So we'll see. All right, well, that's going to do it for our discussion of Halloween Town. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this film or any of the other films we've talked about. Feel free to email us at waltsentmepodcast@gmail.com. You can also interact with us on Twitter @waltsentmepod or on Facebook, which is where?
Facebook.com/waltsentmepod.
And, Kristen, please tell everybody where they can find you.
You can find me on Twitter @Kiernes_film. I also do a classic film podcast where you can learn about old Hollywood. It's atickbusiness.podbean.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
And as for me, you can find me on Twitter @ForgottenFilms. That's films with a Z. You can check out my blog, which is @ForgottenFilmcast.wordpress.com. And that's also where you'll find links to my other podcast, which is called The Forgotten Filmcast. All right. So what is the next movie that we're going to be looking at?
We are going back in time to 1991. We're talking about that time that Goldie Hawn decided to do a murder mystery. We're talking about the Touchstone Pictures film Deceived. Never seen this, but I own the Blu-ray.
Oh, see, and I've never seen this either. And you know, when you put it on the list, I was like, oh, yeah, I've been wanting to check this out just because I'm so intrigued. Because back when this came out, you know, it was like Goldie Hawn is funny lady. And all of a sudden, here's this weird thriller-looking thing, but it's Goldie Hawn. She's the lady from Overboard. This doesn't make sense.
I just watched her in Swing Shift for the first time ever, and that movie is a masterpiece, so I've done seen Goldie Hawn when she's serious. I'm ready.
I'm ready anytime for Goldie Hawn. So, yes. Yeah. All right, well, that's what we're going to be taking a look at next time. Until then, we'll see you later.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.